or place. Mom knows where it is. Uncomplainingly, gladly, she puts things where they belong after the children have strewn them about here, there, and everywhere. Anything the children need or want, Mom will cheerfully get for them. It is the perfect home. Failing to find a comparable peaceful haven in the outside world, it is quite likely that one or more of the brood will remain in or return to the happy home, forever enwombed. The mom may also be the pretty addlepate, with her cult of beauty, clothing, cosmetics, perfumes, hairdos, diet, and exercise, or the pseudo-intellectual who is forever taking courses and attending lectures, not seriously studying one subject and informing herself thoroughly about it, but 1 month mental hygiene, the next economics, Greek architecture, nursery schools. These were the moms of the sons who could not be men at the front or at home, in bed or out, because they really wanted to be babies. All these moms had one thing in common. The emotional satisfaction, almost repletion, she derives from keeping her children paddling about in a kind of psychological, amniotic fluid, rather than letting them swim away with the bold and decisive strokes of maturity from the emotional maternal womb. Being immature herself, she breeds immaturity in her children, and, by and large, they are doomed to lives of personal and social insufficiency and unhappiness. I quote Dr. Strecker at length because he was, oddly enough, one of the psychiatric authorities most frequently cited in the spate of post-war articles and speeches condemning American women for their lost femininity and bidding them rush back home again and devote their lives to their children. Actually, the moral of Strecker's cases was just the opposite. Those immature sons had mothers who devoted too much of their lives to their children, mothers who had to keep their children babies, or they themselves would have no lives at all, mothers who never themselves reached or were encouraged to reach maturity, the state or quality of being mature, ripeness, full development, independence of thought and action, the quality of being fully human, which is not quite the same as femininity. Facts are swallowed by a mystique in much the same way, I guess, as the strange phenomenon by which hamburger eaten by a dog becomes dog, and hamburger eaten by a human becomes human. The facts of the GI's neurosis became, in the 1940s, proof that American women had been seduced from feminine fulfillment by an education geared to career, independence, equality with men, self-realization at any cost, even though most of these frustrated women were simply housewives. By some fascinating paradox, the massive evidence of psychological damage done to boys and girls by frustrated mothers who devoted all their days to filling children's needs was twisted by the feminine mystique to a summons to the new generation of girls to go back home and devote their days to filling children's needs. Nothing made that hamburger more palatable than the early Kinsey figures which showed that sexual frustration in women was related to their education. Chewed and rechewed was a horrendous fact that between 50% and 85% of the college women polled had never experienced sexual orgasm, while less than 1/5 of high school-educated women reported the same problem. As modern women, the lost sex interpreted these early Kinsey returns. Among women with a grade school education or less, complete failure to achieve orgasm diminished toward the vanishing point. Dr. Kinsey and his colleagues reported that practically 100% full orgastic reaction had been found among uneducated Negro women. The psychosexual rule that begins to take form then is this. The more educated the woman is, the greater chance there is of sexual disorder, more or less severe. Nearly a decade went by before publication of the full Kinsey report on women, which completely contradicted those earlier findings. How many women realize even now that Kinsey's 5,940 case histories of American women show that the number of females reaching orgasm in marriage and the number of females reaching orgasm nearly 100% of the time was related to education, but the more educated the woman, the greater chance of sexual fulfillment. The woman with only a grade school education was more likely never to experience orgasm, while the woman who finished college and who went on to graduate a professional school was far more likely to achieve full orgasm nearly 100% of the time. In Kinsey's words, "We found that the number of females reaching orgasm within any 5-year period was rather distinctly higher among those with upper educational backgrounds. In every period of marriage, from the first until at least the 15th year, a larger number of the females in the sample who had more limited educational backgrounds had completely failed to respond to orgasm in their marital coitus, and a small number of the better educated females had so completely failed. These data are not in accord with the preliminary unpublished calculation which we made some years ago. On the basis of a smaller sample and on the basis of a less adequate method of calculation, we seem to find a larger number of the females of the lower educational levels responding to orgasm in the marital coitus. These data now need correction. But the mystique nourished by the early incorrect figures was not so easily corrected. And then there were the frightening figures in case histories of children abandoned and rejected because their mothers worked. How many women realize even now that the babies in those publicized cases who withered away from lack of maternal affection were not the children of educated, middle-class mothers who left them in others' care certain hours of the day to practice a profession or write a poem or fight a political battle, but truly abandoned children? Foundlings often deserted at birth by unwed mothers and drunken fathers, children who never had a home or tender, loving care. Headlines were made by any study which implied that working mothers were responsible for juvenile delinquency, school difficulties, or emotional disturbance in their children. Recently, a psychologist, Dr. Lois Meek-Stultz of Stanford University, analyzed all the evidence from such studies. She discovered that at the present time, one can say anything, good or bad, about children of employed mothers and support the statement by some research findings. But there's no definitive evidence that children are less happy, healthy, adjusted because their mothers work. The studies that show working women to be happier, better, more mature mothers do not get much publicity. Since juvenile delinquency is increasing and more women work or are educated for some kind of intellectual work, there is surely a direct cause and effect relationship, one says. Except that evidence indicates there is not. Several years ago, much publicity was given to a study comparing matched groups of delinquent and non-delinquent boys. It was found, among other things, that there was no more delinquency or school truancy when the mothers worked regularly than when they were housewives. But spectacular headlines warned significantly more delinquents had mothers who worked irregularly. This finding brought guilt and gloom to the educated mothers who had given up full-fledged careers but managed to keep on in their fields by working part-time, by freelancing, or by taking temporary jobs with periods at home in between. Here for years, I've been purposely taking temporary jobs and part-time jobs, trying to arrange my working life in the boys' best interests, one such mother was quoted by the New York Times, and now it looks as though I've been doing the worst possible thing. Actually, this mother, a woman with professional training who lived in a comfortable middle-class neighborhood, was equating herself with mothers in that study who, it turned out, not only lived in poor socioeconomic circumstances, but had, in many cases, been juvenile delinquents themselves. And they often had husbands who were emotionally disturbed. The researchers who did that study suggested that the sons of these women had emotional conflicts because the mother was motivated by her sporadic work, not so much to supplement family income as to escape household and maternal responsibilities. But another specialist analyzing the same findings thought the basic cause both of the mother's sporadic employment and the son's delinquency was the emotional instability of both parents. Whatever the reason, the situation was in no way comparable to that of most educated women who read themselves into it. In fact, as Dr. Stultz shows, many studies misinterpreted as proof that women cannot combine careers and motherhood actually indicate that, where other conditions are equal, the children of mothers who work because they want to are less likely to be disturbed, have problems in school, or to lack a sense of personal worth than housewives' children. The early studies of children of working mothers were done in an era when few married women worked at day nurseries which served working mothers who were without husbands due to death, divorce, or desertion. These studies were done by social workers and economists in order to press for such reforms as mothers' pensions. The disturbances and higher death rate in such children were not found in studies done in this recent decade, when of the millions of married working women, only 1 out of 8 was not living with her husband. In one such recent study, based on 2,000 mothers, the only significant differences were that more housewife mothers stated, "The children make me nervous," than working mothers. And the housewives seemed to have more children. A famous study in Chicago, which had seemed to show more mothers of delinquents were working outside the home, turned out to show only that more delinquents come from broken homes. Another study of 400 seriously disturbed children of a school population of 16,000 showed that where no broken home was involved, three times as many of the disturbed children's mothers were housewives as working mothers. Other studies show that children of working mothers were less likely to be either extremely aggressive or extremely inhibited, less likely to do poorly in school or to lack a sense of personal worth than children of housewives, and that mothers who worked were more likely to be delighted at becoming pregnant and less likely to suffer conflict over the role of mother than housewives. There also seemed to be a closer and more positive relationship to children among working mothers who liked their work than among housewife mothers or mothers who did not like their work. And a study during the 30s of college-educated mothers who were more able to choose work they like showed no adverse effect of their employment on their marital and emotional adjustment or on number or seriousness of children's problems. In general, women who work shared only two attributes. They were more likely to have higher education and to live in cities. In our own era, however, as droves of educated women have become suburban housewives, who among them did not worry that their child's bedwetting, thumb-sucking, overeating, refusal to eat, withdrawal, lack of friends, inability to be alone, aggressiveness, timidity, slow reading, too much reading, lack of discipline, rigidity, inhibition, exhibitionism, sexual precociousness, or sexual lack of interest was a sign of incipient neurosis? If not actual abnormality or actual delinquency, they must be at least signs of parental failure, portents of future neurosis. Sometimes they were. Parenthood, and especially motherhood under the Freudian spotlight, had to become a full-time job and career, if not a religious cult. One false step could mean disaster. Without careers, without any commitment other than their homes, mothers could devote every moment to their children. Their full attention could be given to finding signs of incipient neurosis, and perhaps to producing it. In every case history, of course, you can always find significant facts about the mother, especially if you are looking for facts or memories of those supposedly crucial first 5 years. In America, after all, the mother is always there. She is supposed to be there. Is the fact that they are always there, and there only as mothers, somehow linked to the neurosis of their children? Many cultures pass on their conflicts to children through the mothers, but in the modern cultures of the civilized world, not many educate their strongest, ablest women to make a career of their own children. Not long ago, Dr. Spock confessed, a bit uneasily, that Russian children, whose mothers usually have some purpose in their lives besides motherhood, they work in medicine, science, education, industry, government, art, seem somehow more stable, adjusted, mature than American children, whose full-time mothers do nothing but worry about them. Could it be that Russian women are somehow better mothers because they have a serious purpose in their own lives? At least, said Dr. Spock, these mothers are more sure of themselves as mothers. They are not, like American mothers, dependent on the latest word from the experts, the newest child care fad. It is clearly a terrible burden on Dr. Spock to have 13,500,000 mothers so unsure of themselves that they bring up their children literally according to his book and call piteously to him for help when the book does not work. No headlines marked the growing concern of psychiatrists with the problem of dependence in American children and grown-up children. The psychiatrist David Levy, in a very famous study of maternal overprotection, studied in exhaustive detail 20 mothers who had damaged their children to a pathological extent by maternal infantilization, indulgence, and overprotection. A typical case was a 12-year-old boy who had infantile temper tantrums in his 11th year when his mother refused to butter his bread for him. He still demanded her help in dressing. He summed up his requirements in life very neatly by saying that his mother would butter his bread for him until he married, after which his wife would do so. All these mothers, according to physiological indexes such as menstrual flow, breast milk, and early indications of a maternal type of behavior, were unusually strong in their feminine or maternal instinctual base, if it can be described that way. All but two of the 20, as Dr. Levy himself described it, were responsible, stable, and aggressive. The active or aggressive feature of the responsible behavior was regarded as a distinctly maternal type of behavior. It characterized the lives of 18 of the 20 overprotecting mothers since childhood. In none was there any tinge of unconscious rejection of the child or of motherhood. What made these 20 strongly maternal women, evidently strength, even aggression, is not masculine when a psychiatrist considers it part of the maternal instinct, produce such pathologically infantile sons. For one thing, the child was utilized as a means of satisfying an abnormal craving for love. These mothers freshened up, put lipstick on when the son was due home from school, as a wife for a husband or a girl for her date, because they had no other life besides the child. Most, Levy said, had thwarted career ambitions. The maternal overprotection was actually caused by these mothers' strength, by their basic feminine energy, responsible, stable, active, and aggressive, producing pathology in the child when the mother was blocked from other channels of expression. Most of these mothers also had dominating mothers and submissive fathers of their own, and their husbands had also been obedient sons of dominating mothers. In Freudian terms, the castrativeness all around was rather extreme. The sons and mothers were given intensive psychoanalytic therapy for years, which, it was hoped, would break the pathological cycle. But when, some years after the original study, research workers checked on these women and the children they had pathologically overprotected, the results were not quite what was expected. In most cases, psychotherapy had not been effective. Yet some of the children, miraculously, did not become pathological adults, not because of therapy, but because by circumstance the mother had acquired an interest or activity in her own life and had simply stopped living the child's life for him. In a few other cases, the child survived because, through his own ability, he had staked out an area of independence of which his mother was not a part. Other clues to the real problem of the mother-child relationship in America have been seen by social scientists without ever penetrating the mystique. A sociologist named Arnold Green almost by accident discovered another dimension to the relationship between nurturing mother love, or its lack, and neurosis. It seems that in the Massachusetts industrial town where Green grew up, an entire generation was raised under psychological conditions which should have been traumatic. Conditions of irrational, vengeful, even brutal parental authority, and a complete lack of love between parent and child. The parents, Polish immigrants, tried to enforce rigid, old-world rules which their American children did not respect. The children's ridicule, anger, contempt made the bewildered parents resort to a vengeful, personal, irrational authority which no longer finds support in the future hopes and ambitions of the children. In exasperation and fear of losing all control of their Americanized youngsters, parents apply the fist and whip rather indiscriminately. The sound of blows, screams, howls, vexations, wails of torment and hatred are so commonplace along the rows of dilapidated mill houses that the passerby pay them scant attention. Surely here were the seeds of future neuroses as all good post-Freudian parents in America understand them. But to Green's amazement, when he went back and checked as a sociologist on the neuroses which, according to the book, must surely be flourishing, he found no known case of army rejection because of psychoneurosis in the local Polish community, and in the overt behavior of an entire generation in the village, no expression of anxiety, guilty feelings, rigidity of response, repressed hostility, the various symptoms described as characteristic of the basic neurotic character. Green wondered, why didn't those children become neurotic? Why weren't they destroyed by that brutal, irrational parental authority? They had none of that constant and watchful nurturing love that is urged on middle-class mothers by the child psychologizers. Their mothers, like their fathers, worked all day in the factory. They had been left in the care of older sisters or brothers, had run free in fields and woods, had avoided the parents wherever possible. In these families, stress was placed upon work rather than personal sentiment. Respect, not love, is the tie that binds. Demonstrations of affection were not altogether lacking, Green said. But they had little in common with the definitions of parent-child love found in the middle-class women's magazines. It occurred to the sociologist that perhaps the very absence of this omnipresent nurturing mother love might explain why these children did not suffer the neurotic symptoms so commonly found in the sons of middle-class parents. The Polish parents' authority, however brutal and irrational, was external to the core of the self, as Green put it. The Polish parents did not have the technique or opportunity to absorb the personality of the child. Perhaps, Green suggested, lack of love and irrational authority do not in themselves cause neurosis, but only within a certain context of personality absorption, the physical and emotional blanketing of the child, which brings about the slavish dependence upon the parents found among children of the native white American urban college-educated middle class. Is lack of love the cause of neurosis, or the middle-class parental nurturing which absorbs the child's independent self and creates in him an excessive need for love? Psychoanalysts had always concentrated on the seeds of neuroses. Green wanted to find out what there is to being a modern middle-class parent that fertilizes the soil of the child's neurosis, however the individual seed is planted. As usual, the arrow pointed unerringly to the mother. But Green was not concerned with helping the modern American mother adjust to her role. On the contrary, he found that she lacked any real role as a woman in modern society. She enters marriage and perhaps bears a child with no definite role and series of functions as formerly. She feels inferior to man because comparatively she has been and is more restricted. The extent of the actual emancipation of women has been commonly exaggerated. Through a good marriage, the middle-class girl attains far more status than is possible through a career of her own. But the period of phantom dalliance with a career or an embarkation upon one leave her ill-fitted for the drudgery of house cleaning, diapers, and the preparation of meals. The mother has little to do in or out of the home. She is her single child's sole companion. Modern scientific child care enforces a constant supervision and diffused worrying over the child's health, eating spinach, and ego development. This is complicated by the fact that much energy is spent forcing early walking, toilet training, talking, because in an intensely competitive milieu, middle-class parents from the day of birth are constantly comparing their own child's development with that of the neighbor's children. Perhaps, Green speculates, middle-class mothers have made love of supreme importance in their relation to the child, theirs for him and his for them, partly because of the love complex of our time, which is particularly ramified within the middle class, and partly as a compensation for the many sacrifices they have made for the child. The child's need for love is experienced precisely because he has been conditioned to need it, conditioned to a slavish emotional dependence. Not the need for parental love, but the constant threat of its withdrawal after the child has been conditioned to the need, lies at the root of the most characteristic modern neuroses. Mama won't like you if you don't eat your spinach, or stop dribbling your milk, or get down from that Davenport. To the extent that a child's personality has been absorbed, he will be thrown into a panic by this sort of treatment. In such a child, a disapproving glance may produce more terror than a 20-minute lashing in little Stanislaus Walczyk. Green was only concerned with mothers in terms of their effect on their sons. But it occurred to him that personality absorption alone cannot, after all, explain neurosis. Because otherwise, he says, middle-class women of the previous generation would all have suffered such neuroses, and nobody recorded such suffering in those women. Certainly the personality of the middle-class girl of the late 19th century was absorbed by her parents, by the demands of love and unquestioning obedience. However, the rate of neurosis under those conditions was probably not too high, the sociologist concludes, because even though the woman's own personality was absorbed, it was consistently absorbed within a role which changed relatively slightly from childhood into adolescence, courtship, and finally into marriage. She never could be her own person. The modern middle-class boy, on the other hand, is forced to compete with others, to achieve, which demands a certain degree of independence, firmness of purpose, aggressiveness, self-assertion. Thus, in the boy, the mother-nourished need for everyone to love him, the inability to erect his own values and purposes is neurotic, but not in the girl. It is provocative, the speculation made by a sociologist in 1946, but it never penetrated far beyond the inner circles of social theory, never permeated the bulwarks of the feminine mystique, despite increasing national awareness that something was wrong with American mothers. Even the sociologist who managed to get behind the mystique and see children in terms other than their need for more mother love was concerned only with the problem of the sons. But was not the real implication that the role of the middle-class American housewife forces many a mother to smother, absorb, the personality of both her sons and daughters? Many saw the tragic waste of American sons who were made incapable of achievement, individual values, independent action. But they did not see as tragic the waste of the daughters or of the mothers to whom it happened generations earlier. If a culture does not expect human maturity from its women, it does not see its lack as a waste or as a possible cause of neurosis or conflict. The insult, the real reflection on our culture's definition of the role of women, is that as a nation we only noticed that something was wrong with women when we saw its effects on their sons. Is it surprising that we misunderstood what was really wrong? How could we understand it in the static terms of functionalism and adjustment? Educators and sociologists applauded when the personality of the middle-class girl was consistently absorbed from childhood through adulthood by her role as woman. Long live the role if adjustment is served. The waste of a human self was not considered a phenomenon to be studied in women. Only the frustration caused by cultural inconsistencies in role conditioning, as the great social scientist Ruth Benedict described the plight of American women. Even women themselves who felt the misery, the helplessness of their lack of self, did not understand the feeling. It became the problem that has no name. And in their shame and guilt, they turned again to their children to escape the problem. So the circle completes itself. From mother to sons and daughters, generation after generation. The unremitting attack on women, which has become an American preoccupation in recent years, might also stem from the same escapist motives that sent men and women back to the security of the home. Mother love is said to be sacred in America, but with all the reverence and lip service she is paid, mom is a pretty safe target, no matter how correctly or incorrectly her failures are interpreted. No one has ever been blacklisted or fired for an attack on the American woman. Apart from the psychological pressures for mothers or wives, there have been plenty of non-sexual pressures in the America of the last decade. The compromising, never-ceasing competition, the anonymous and often purposeless work in a big organization that also kept a man from feeling like a man. Safer to take it out on his wife and his mother than to recognize a failure in himself. Or in the sacred American way of life. The men were not always kidding when they said their wives were lucky to be able to stay home all day. It was also soothing to rationalize the rat race by telling themselves that they were in it for their wife and kids. And so men recreated their own childhood in suburbia and made mothers of their wives. Men fell for the mystique without a murmur of dissent. It promised them mothers for the rest of their lives, both as a reason for their being and as an excuse for their failures. Is it so strange that boys who grew up with too much mother love become men who can never get enough? But why did women sit still for this barrage of blame? When a culture has erected barrier after barrier against women as separate selves, when a culture has erected legal, political, social, economic, and educational barriers to women's own acceptance of maturity, even after most of those barriers are down, it is still easier for a woman to seek the sanctuary of the home. It is easier to live through her husband and children than to make a road of her own in the world, for she is the daughter of that same mom who made it so hard for girl as well as boy to grow up. And freedom is a frightening thing. It is frightening to grow up finally and be free of passive dependence. Why should a woman bother to be anything more than a wife and mother? If all the forces of her culture tell her she doesn't have to, we'll be better off not to grow up. And so the American woman made her mistaken choice. She ran back home again to live by sex alone, trading in her individuality for security. Her husband was drawn in after her, and the door was shut against the outside world. They began to live the pretty lie of the feminine mystique. But could either of them really believe it? She was, after all, an American woman, an irreversible product of a culture that stops just short of giving her a separate identity. He was, after all, an American man whose respect for individuality and freedom of choice are his nation's pride. They went to school together. He knows who she is. Does his meek willingness to wax the floor and wash the dishes when he comes home tired on the 6:55 hide from both the guilty awareness of the reality behind the pretty lie? What keeps them believing it in spite of the warning signs that have cropped up all over the suburban lot? What keeps women home? What force in our culture is strong enough to write occupation housewife so large that all other possibilities for women have been almost obscured? Powerful forces in this nation must be served by those pretty domestic pictures that stare at us everywhere, forbidding a woman to use her own abilities in the world. The preservation of the feminine mystique in this sense could have implications that are not sexual at all. When one begins to think about it, America depends rather heavily on women's passive dependence, their femininity. Femininity, if one still wants to call it that, makes American women a target and a victim of the sexual cell. Chapter 9, The Sexual Cell. Some months ago, as I began to fit together the puzzle of women's retreat to home, I had the feeling I was missing something. I could trace the routes by which sophisticated thought circled back on itself to perpetuate an obsolete image of femininity. I could see how that image meshed with prejudice and misinterpreted frustrations to hide the emptiness of occupation housewife from women themselves. But what powers it all? If, despite the nameless desperation of so many American housewives, despite the opportunities open to all women now, so few have any purpose in life other than to be a wife and mother, somebody, something pretty powerful, must be at work. The energy behind the feminist movement was too dynamic merely to have trickled dry. It must have been turned off, diverted, by something more powerful than that underestimated power of women. There are certain facts of life so obvious and mundane that one never talks about them. Only the child blurts out, "Why do people in books never go to the toilet? Why is it never said that the really crucial function, the really important role that women serve as housewives is to buy more things for the house?" In all the talk of femininity and woman's role, one forgets that the real business of America is business. But the perpetuation of housewifery, the growth of the feminine mystique, makes sense and dollars when one realizes that women are the chief customers of American business. Somehow, somewhere, someone must have figured out that women will buy more things if they are kept in the underused, nameless, yearning, energy-to-get-rid-of state of being housewives. I have no idea how it happened. Decision-making in industry is not as simple, as rational, as those who believe the conspiratorial theories of history would have it. I am sure the heads of General Foods and General Electric and General Motors and Macy's and Gimbel's and the assorted directors of all the companies that make detergents and electric mixers and red stoves with rounded corners and synthetic furs and waxes and hair coloring and patterns for home sewing and home carpentry and lotions for detergent hands and bleaches to keep the towels pure white never sat down around a mahogany conference table in a boardroom on Madison Avenue or Wall Street and voted on a motion. "Gentlemen, I move, in the interest of all, that we begin a concerted $50 billion campaign to stop this dangerous movement of American women out of the home. We've got to keep them housewives, and let's not forget it." A thinking vice president says, "Too many women getting educated. Don't want to stay home. Unhealthy. If they all get to be scientists and such, they won't have time to shop. But how can we keep them home? They want careers now." "We'll liberate them to have careers at home," the new executive with horn-rimmed glasses and the PhD in psychology suggests. "We'll make homemaking creative." Of course, it didn't happen quite like that. It was not an economic conspiracy directed against women. It was a byproduct of our general confusion lately of means with ends, just something that happened to women when the business of producing and selling and investing in business for profit, which is merely the way our economy is organized to serve man's needs efficiently, began to be confused with the purpose of our nation, the end of life itself. No more surprising, the subversion of women's lives in America to the ends of business than the subversion of the sciences of human behavior to the business of deluding women about their real needs. It would take a clever economist to figure out what would keep our affluent economy going if the housewife market began to fall off, just as an economist would have to figure out what to do if there were no threat of war. It is easy to see why it happened. I learned how it happened when I went to see a man who is paid approximately $1 million a year for his professional services in manipulating the emotions of American women to serve the needs of business. This particular man got in on the ground floor of the hidden persuasion business in 1945 and kept going. The headquarters of his Institute for Motivational Manipulation is a baronial mansion in Upper Westchester. The walls of a ballroom, two stories high, are filled with steel shelves holding 1,000-odd studies for business and industry, 300,000 individual depth interviews, mostly with American housewives. He let me see what I wanted, said I could use anything that was not confidential to a specific company. Nothing there for anyone to hide, to feel guilty about. Only in page after page of those depth studies, a shrewd, cheerful awareness of the empty, purposeless, uncreative, even sexually joyless lives that most American housewives lead. In his own unabashed terms, this most helpful of hidden persuaders showed me the function served by keeping American women housewives. The reservoir that their lack of identity, lack of purpose, creates, to be manipulated into dollars at the point of purchase. Properly manipulated, if you are not afraid of that word, he said, American housewives can be given the sense of identity, purpose, creativity, the self-realization, even the sexual joy they lack, by the buying of things. I suddenly realized the significance of the boast that women wield 75% of the purchasing power in America. I suddenly saw American women as victims of that ghastly gift, that power at the point of purchase. The insights he shared with me so liberally revealed many things. The dilemma of business was spelled out in a survey made in 1945 for the publisher of a leading women's magazine on the attitudes of women toward electrical appliances. The message was considered of interest to all the companies that, with the war about to end, were going to have to make consumer sales take the place of war contracts. It was a study of the psychology of housekeeping. A woman's attitude toward housekeeping appliances cannot be separated from her attitude toward homemaking in general, it warned. On the basis of a national sample of 4,500 wives, middle class, high school, or college educated, American women were divided into three categories: the true housewife type, the career woman, and the balanced homemaker. While 51% of the women then fitted the true housewife type, from the psychological point of view, housekeeping is this woman's dominating interest. She takes the utmost pride and satisfaction in maintaining a comfortable and well-run home for her family. Consciously or subconsciously, she feels that she is indispensable and that no one else can take over her job. She has little, if any, desire for a position outside the home, and if she has one, it is through force or circumstances or necessity. It was apparent that this group was diminishing and probably would continue to do so as new fields, interests, education were now open to women. The largest market for appliances, however, was this true housewife, though she had a certain reluctance to accept new devices that had to be recognized and overcome. She may even fear that they, appliances, will render unnecessary the old-fashioned way of doing things that has always suited her. After all, housework was the justification for her whole existence. I don't think there's any way to make housework easier for myself, one true housewife said, because I don't believe that a machine can take the place of hard work. The second type, the career woman or would-be career woman, was a minority, but an extremely unhealthy one from the seller's standpoint. Advertisers were warned that it would be to their advantage not to let this group get any larger. For such women, though not necessarily job holders, do not believe that a woman's place is primarily in the home. Many in this group have never actually worked, but their attitude is, I think housekeeping is a horrible waste of time. If my youngsters were old enough and I were free to leave the house, I would use my time to better advantage. My family's meals and laundry could be taken care of. I would be delighted to go out and get a job. The point to bear in mind regarding career women, the study said, is that while they buy modern appliances, they are not the ideal type of customer. They are too critical. The third type, the balanced homemaker, is, from the market standpoint, the ideal type. She has some outside interests or has held a job before turning exclusively to homemaking. She readily accepts the help mechanical appliances can give, but does not expect them to do the impossible because she needs to use her own executive ability in managing a well-run household. The moral of the study was explicit. Since the balanced homemaker represents the market with the greatest future potential, it would be to the advantage of the appliance manufacturer to make more and more women aware of the desirability of belonging to this group. Educate them through advertising that it is possible to have outside interests and become alert to wider intellectual influences without becoming a career woman. The art of good homemaking should be the goal of every normal woman. The problem, which, if recognized at that time by one hidden persuader for the home appliance industry, was surely recognized by others with products for the home, was that a whole new generation of women is being educated to do work outside the home. Furthermore, an increased desire for emancipation is evident. The solution, quite simply, was to encourage them to be modern housewives. The career or would-be career woman who frankly dislikes cleaning, dusting, ironing, washing clothes is less interested in a new wax, a new soap powder, unlike the true housewife and the balanced homemaker who prefer to have sufficient appliances and do the housework themselves. The career woman would prefer servants. Housework takes too much time and energy. She buys appliances, however, whether or not she has servants, but she is more likely to complain about the service they give and to be harder to sell. It was too late, impossible, to turn these modern could or would-be career women back into true housewives. But the study pointed out in 1945 the potential for balanced housewifery, the home career. Let them want to have their cake and eat it too. Save time, have more comfort, avoid dirt and disorder, have mechanized supervision, yet not want to give up the feeling of personal achievement and pride in a well-run household, which comes from doing it yourself. As one young housewife said, it's nice to be modern. It's like running a factory in which you have all the latest machinery. But it was not an easy job, either for business or advertisers. New gadgets that were able to do almost all the housework crowded the market. Increased ingenuity was needed to give American women that feeling of achievement and yet keep housework their main purpose in life. Education, independence, growing individuality, everything that made them ready for other purposes had constantly to be countered, channeled back to the home. The manipulator's services became increasingly valuable. In later surveys, he no longer interviewed professional women. They were not at home during the day. The women in his samples were deliberately true or balanced housewives, the new suburban housewives. Household and consumer products are, after all, geared to women. 75% of all consumer advertising budgets is spent to appeal to women. That is, to housewives, the women who are available during the day to be interviewed, the women with the time for shopping. Naturally, his depth interviews, projective tests, living laboratories, were designed to impress his clients, but more often than not, they contained the shrewd insights of a skilled social scientist, insights that could be used with profit. His clients were told they had to do something about this growing need of American women to do creative work, the major unfulfilled need of the modern housewife. He wrote in one report, for example, "Every effort must be made to sell X-Mix as a base upon which the woman's creative effort is used. The appeal should emphasize the fact that X-Mix aids the woman in expressing her creativity because it takes the drudgery away. At the same time, stress should be laid upon the cookie manipulations, the fun that goes with them, permitting you to feel that X-Mix baking is real baking." But the dilemma again, how to make her spend money on the mix that takes some of the drudgery out of baking by telling her she can utilize her energy where it really counts. and yet keep her from being too busy to bake. I don't use the mix because I don't do any baking at all. It's too much trouble. I live in a sprawled-out apartment, and what with keeping it clean and looking after my child and my part-time job, I don't have time for baking. What to do about their feeling of disappointment when the biscuits come out of the oven and they're really only bread and there is no feeling of creative achievement? Why should I bake my own biscuits when there are so many good things on the market that just need to be heated up? It just doesn't make any sense at all to go through all the trouble of mixing your own and then greasing the tin and baking them. What to do when the woman doesn't get the feeling her mother got, when the cake had to be made from scratch? The way my mother made them, you had to sift the flour yourself and add the eggs and the butter, and you knew you'd really make something you could be proud of. The problem can be handled, the report assured. By using X-Mix, the woman can prove herself as a wife and mother, not only by baking, but by spending more time with her family. Of course, it must also be made clear that home-baked foods are in every way preferable to bakery shop foods. Above all, give X-Mix a therapeutic value by downplaying the easy recipes, emphasizing instead the stimulating effort of baking. From an advertising viewpoint, this means stressing that with X-Mix in the home, you will be a different woman, a happier woman. Further, the client was told that a phrase in his ad, "and you make that cake the easiest, laziest way there is," evoked a negative response in American housewives. It hit too close to their underlying guilt. Since they never feel that they are really exerting sufficient effort, it is certainly wrong to tell them that baking with X-Mix is a lazy way. Supposing, he suggested, that this devoted wife and mother behind the kitchen stove, anxiously preparing a cake or pie for her husband or children, is simply indulging her own hunger for sweets. The very fact that baking is work for the housewife helps her dispel any doubts that she might have about her real motivations. But there are even ways to manipulate the housewife's guilt, the report said. It might be possible to suggest through advertising that not to take advantage of all 12 uses of X-Mix is to limit your efforts to give pleasure to your family. A transfer of guilt might be achieved. Rather than feeling guilty about using X-Mix for dessert food, the woman would be made to feel guilty if she doesn't take advantage of this opportunity to give her family 12 different and delicious treats. Don't waste your skill. Don't limit yourself. By the mid-50s, the surveys reported with pleasure that the career woman, the woman who clamored for equality, almost for identity in every sphere of life, the woman who reacted to domestic slavery with indignation and vehemence, was gone, replaced by the less worldly, less sophisticated woman whose activity in PTA gives her broad contacts with the world outside her home, but who finds in housework a medium of expression for her femininity and individuality. She's not like the old-fashioned self-sacrificing housewife. She considers herself the equal of man, but she still feels lazy, neglectful, haunted by guilt feelings because she doesn't have enough work to do. The advertiser must manipulate her need for a feeling of creativeness into the buying of his product. After an initial resistance, she now tends to accept instant coffee, frozen foods, pre-cooked foods, and labor-saving items as part of her routine. But she needs a justification, and she finds it in the thought that by using frozen foods, I'm freeing myself to accomplish other important tasks as a modern mother and wife. Creativeness is the modern woman's dialectical answer to the problem of her changed position in the household. Thesis, I'm a housewife. Antithesis, I hate drudgery. Synthesis, I am creative. This means essentially that even though the housewife may buy canned food, for instance, and thus save time and effort, she doesn't let it go at that. She has a great need for doctoring up the can and thus prove her personal participation and her concern with giving satisfaction to her family. The feeling of creativeness also serves another purpose. It is an outlet for the liberated talents, the better taste, the freer imagination, the greater initiative of the modern woman. It permits her to use at home all the faculties that she would display in an outside career. The yearning for creative opportunities and moments is a major aspect of buying motivations. The only trouble, the surveys warned, is that she tries to use her own mind and her own judgment She is fast getting away from judging by collective or majority standards. She is developing independent standards. Never mind the neighbors. I don't want to live up to them or compare myself to them at every turn. She can't always be reached now with keep up with the Joneses. The advertiser must appeal to her own need to live. Appeal to this thirst. Tell her that you are adding more zest, more enjoyment to her life, that it is within her reach now to taste new experiences, and that she is entitled to taste these experiences. Even more positively, you should convey that you are giving her lessons in living. House cleaning should be fun, the manufacturer of a certain cleaning device was advised. Even though his product was perhaps less efficient than the vacuum cleaner, it let the housewife use more of her own energy in the work. Further, it let the housewife have the illusion that she has become a professional, an expert in determining which cleaning tools to use for specific jobs. This professionalization is a psychological defense of the housewife against being a general cleaner-upper and menial servant for her family in a day and age of general work emancipation. The role of expert serves a twofold emotional function. One, it helps the housewife achieve status, and two, she moves beyond the orbit of her home into the world of modern science in her search for new and better ways of doing things. As a result, there has never been a more favorable psychological climate for household appliances and products. The modern housewife is actually aggressive in her efforts to find those household products which, in her expert opinion, really meet her need. This trend accounts for the popularity of different waxes and polishes for different materials in the home, for the growing use of floor polishers, and for the variety of mops and cleaning implements for floors and walls. The difficulty is to give her the sense of achievement, of ego enhancement, she has been persuaded to seek in the housewife profession, when, in actuality, her time-consuming task, housekeeping, is not only endless, it is a task for which society hires the lowliest, least trained, most trod upon individuals and groups. Anyone with a strong enough back and a small enough brain can do these menial chores. But even this difficulty can be manipulated to sell her more things. One of the ways that the housewife raises her own prestige as a cleaner of her home is through the use of specialized products for specialized tasks. When she uses one product for washing clothes, a second for dishes, a third for walls, a fourth for floors, a fifth for Venetian blinds, etc., rather than an all-purpose cleaner, she feels less like an unskilled laborer, more like an engineer, an expert. The second way of raising her own stature is to do things my way, to establish an expert's role for herself by creating her own tricks of the trade. For example, she may always put a bit of bleach in all my washing, even color, to make them really clean. Help her to justify her menial task by building up her role as the protector of her family, the killer of millions of microbes and germs, this report advised. Emphasize her kingpin role in the family. Help her be an expert rather than a menial worker. Make housework a matter of knowledge and skill rather than a matter of brawn and dull, unremitting effort. An effective way of doing this is to bring out a new product. For, it seems, there's a growing wave of housewives who look forward to new products which not only decrease their daily workload, but actually engage their emotional and intellectual interest in the world of scientific development outside the home. One gasps in admiration at the ingenuity of it all. The housewife can participate in science itself just by buying something new or something old that has been given a brand new personality. Besides increasing her professional status, a new cleaning appliance or product increases a woman's feeling of economic security and luxury, just as a new automobile does for a man. This was reported by 28% of the respondents who agreed with this particular sentiment. I like to try out new things. I've just started to use a new liquid detergent, and somehow it makes me feel like a queen. The question of letting the woman use her mind and even participate in science through housework is, however, not without its drawbacks. Science should not relieve housewives of too much drudgery. It must concentrate instead on creating the illusion of that sense of achievement that housewives seem to need. To prove this point, 250 housewives were given a depth test. They were asked to choose among four imaginary methods of cleaning. The first was a completely automatic dust and dirt removal system, which operated continuously like a home heating system. The second, the housewife had to press a button to start. The third was portable. She had to carry it around and point it at an area to remove the dirt. The fourth was a brand new modern object with which she could sweep the dirt away herself. The housewife spoke up in favor of this last appliance. If it appears new, modern, she would rather have the one that lets her work herself, the report said. One compelling reason is her desire to be a participant, not just a button pusher. As one housewife remarked, as for some magical push-button cleaning system, well, what would happen to my exercise, my feeling of accomplishment, and what would I do with my mornings? This fascinating study, incidentally, revealed that a certain electronic cleaning appliance, long considered one of our great labor savers, actually made housekeeping more difficult than it need be. From the response of 80% of those housewives, it seemed that once a woman got this appliance going, she felt compelled to do cleaning that wasn't really necessary. The electronic appliance actually dictated the extent and type of cleaning to be done. Should the housewife then be encouraged to go back to that simple, cheap sweeper that let her clean only as much as she felt necessary? No, said the report, of course not. Simply give that old-fashioned sweeper the status of the electronic appliance as a labor-saving necessity for the modern housewife, and then indicate that the modern homemaker would, naturally, own both. No one, not even the depth researchers, denied that housework was endless and its boring repetition just did not give that much satisfaction, did not require that much vaunted expert knowledge. But the endlessness of it all was an advantage from the seller's point of view. The problem was to keep at bay the underlying realization which was lurking dangerously in thousands of depth interviews which we have conducted for dozens of different kinds of house cleaning products, the realization that, as one housewife said, it stinks, I have to do it, so I do it. It's a necessary evil, that's all. What to do? For one thing, put out more and more products, make the directions more complicated, make it really necessary for the housewife to be an expert. Washing clothes, the report advised, must become more than a matter of throwing clothes into a machine and pouring in soap. Garments must be carefully sorted, one load given treatment A, a second load treatment B, some washed by hand. The housewife can then take great pride in knowing just which of the arsenal of products to use on each occasion. Capitalize, the report continued, on housewives' guilt over the hidden dirt, so she will rip her house to shreds in a deep cleaning operation, which will give her a sense of completeness for a few weeks. The times of thorough cleaning are the points at which she is most willing to try new products, and deep clean advertising holds out the promise of completion. The seller must also stress the joys of completing each separate task, remembering that nearly all housekeepers, even those who thoroughly detest their job, paradoxically find escape from their endless fate by accepting it, by throwing myself into it, as she says. Losing herself in her work, surrounded by all the implements, creams, powders, soaps, she forgets for a time how soon she will have to redo the task. In other words, a housewife permits herself to forget for a moment how rapidly the sink will again fill with dishes, how quickly the floor will again be dirty, and she seizes the moment of completion of a task as a moment of pleasure as pure as if she had just finished a masterpiece of art which would stand as a monument to her credit forever. This is the kind of creative experience the seller of things can give the housewife. In one housewife's own words, I don't like housework at all. I'm a lousy houseworker, but once in a while I get pepped up and I really go to town. When I have some new kind of cleaning material, like when glass wax first came out or those silicone furniture polishes, I got a real kick out of it, and I went through the house shining everything. I like to see the things shine. I feel so good when I see the bathroom just glistening. And so the manipulator advised, identify your product with the physical and spiritual rewards she derives from the almost religious feeling of basic security provided by her home. Talk about her light, happy, peaceful feelings, her deep sense of achievement. But remember, she doesn't really want praise for the sake of praise. Also remember that her mood is not simply gay. She is tired and a bit solemn. Superficially cheerful adjectives or colors will not reflect her feelings. she will react much more favorably to simple, warm, and sincere messages. In the 50s came the revolutionary discovery of the teenage market. Teenagers and young marrieds began to figure prominently in the surveys. It was discovered that young wives who had only been to high school and had never worked